In the first year of peace, more than 2 million couples were married. By 1950, 21 million babies had been born in a seemingly endless baby boom.
I am a few hours old. I am going to be an only child. My mother, innocent as I, will never have another. I drink my bottled milk, feel the pain of birth and circumcision, try to focus, reach fists out toward the lights.
Cruising down the river on a Sunday afternoon.
The years in your ears, mid-century to century 2000. This is an audio history of your first 50 years, Mark, prepared for your entertainment by the Graphophone Entertainment Group. In 1950, while you were born like so many others like you, this busy nation hung out a clean hand to the victims of the past and discovered the mouse-tongued enema of tomorrow. Primitive, black-and-white, single-system TWEV obsessed the snowbound American family and you. Nobody wanted to remember anything, but they taught you drop drill. Remember, Nellie?
Yes, Jim. They were the fabulous 50s, a lavish epoch of rhinestones and chrome, set against the basic black of daily life. While your lucky mom drove a hard top and a dishwasher, Pop relaxed with a flat top and his choice of newspapers.
Wasn't that something? But you were too young then to be a juvenile delinquent, and not old enough to care by the time was up for the old general. Before you could help it, you were growing to adult manhood in the swinging 60s.
By 1960, color was an everyday necessity. That way, within a few short years, the once easy choice between mom and bad and good and dad had to be made in the marketplace of public confusion. Famous heroes came and went. Business improved.
Boy, did it.
The 1960s were an explosive time in America, a decade that rocked the country and changed the world forever. But what triggered the eruption? The youthful rebellion, the racial conflict, the war in the streets. It was a question that haunted one of the leading reporters of his generation as he witnessed firsthand America's involvement in a fateful conflict in a far-off country called Vietnam. His name was David Halberstam.
I thought all the things that contributed to the revolution in the 60s were seeded in the 50s. A British historian named Robert Payne came and visited this country in 1949, and he wrote, "America sits bestride the world like a colossus."
Every day it's getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster.
Love, today we look back on the 50s as a time of peace and prosperity, innocence and laughter. But the decade was, in fact, full of conflict and contradiction. Beneath the surface, there lurked hidden desires, growing struggles, and brash ambitions that gave birth to many of the things, good and bad, that define the American character. This is the story of how we were shaped by a time that started when a world war ended and a terrifying Cold War began.
Going faster than a roller coaster.
What worried many Americans was not the conformity of their own lives, but communist Russia. In the early post-war period, the United States was confident that its nuclear monopoly would keep the growing Soviet threat in check. Then, in August 1949, the Soviets successfully tested a bomb of their own. It was called Joe 1.
Huh? Aren't you Mr. and Mrs. John Smith from any town, USA?
Hello.
I'm Joe, boy, and this here's Ed.
Hey, I'm not really Mr. and Mrs. John Smith.
Well, that's okay. I'm not Joe.
Yeah? He's not Ed. Huh?
America was no longer the only member of the nuclear club. There were many who felt that America's new, more prosperous way of life was in deadly peril. America's scientists began to search for a new, more powerful weapon. After World War II, nuclear weapons became the centerpiece of American defense policy. The Pentagon thought that the atomic bomb would provide a better and cheaper alternative to conventional forces.
Here it is, General Groves, plutonium.
Once the Russians had a bomb of their own, the race now began to build the ultimate weapon, the hydrogen bomb.
In fact, the president in particular had never heard of the idea of a hydrogen bomb until October 1949. There was so little military necessity for this weapon, if you will, that no one had even bothered to mention it to him. Nor had the Joint Chiefs heard of the idea. But within 5 minutes of the time President Truman heard, he asked two questions, according to Sidney Sowers, who was his head of the National Security Council. Can we do it? And Sowers said, well, Mr. President, the scientists say we can. And then the president said, well, hell, why aren't we?
Physicist Edward Teller had been asking just that question for many years. A member of the team that produced the Hiroshima bomb, he called his design for his new bomb the Super, and urged America to develop it quickly.
On the basis of present trends, we must conclude that 10 years from now, Russia will be way ahead of us.
Our office leaks the basic info to the technocrats and the high rollers who know how to use this stuff to keep our country great.
Come on, tire biter.
What would we do if Russia ever got this stereo business first? They'd use Tchaikovsky to take over the free world. Comes a showdown instead of Manhattan. You got nothing but Swan Lake.
I say that this will happen. Not unless we do this or that. I simply say it will happen.
If there is another world war, this civilization may go under.
Robert Oppenheimer, leader of the original atomic bomb effort, had grave doubts that any new weapon could guarantee peace.
Now, just take a peek. Over there by that big black cone. That's Harry Oppenheimer. The underfed guy with the pork pie hat and the pipe?
Yes.
Yeah, he's head oral physicist on the FX project. They call him Hoppy. Intellectual. The general hates his guts. Thinks he's a Ruski spy. Firebiter.
Yeah. Oh.
I'd like you to meet Hoppy Oppenheimer.
Oh.
He'll kind of give you a ringside blow by blow, all right?
Glad to meet you, sir.
What did you say?
Take out your earplugs, sir.
Your earplugs?
There we are. Yes, well, Dr. Oppenheimer, I'm glad to meet you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Call me Hoppy, sir.
No.
Very glad to meet you. I seldom go to the movies, Mr. Tyabutter, but the president showed me one of your pictures at the White House when I was a guest in 43.
Really?
Get our minds off the damn war, he said.
Oh, well, I didn't know that.
We all had martinis, and I'm afraid Mrs. R. might have slept through the last part, but the president especially liked that song about bringing the war back home.
Oh, yes, bringing the war back home. We had lots of chorus girls. It was wonderful.
I've been told you're Mr. Pingo's special representative. Mm-hmm. I hope you'll be able to figure a way to get us things out of the hands of the military and let young Americans get a listen to it.
Well, I thought this was our ultimate secret weapon, Doctor.
That can only be used against people, sir. I never wanted this. My interest in sonic reinforcement was always strictly theoretical. Uh-huh. A question of fundamental research. I always liked sound, Mr. Tyabiter. Sound and arithmetic. If I showed you a diagram for that thing out there, you would not have the faintest idea what it could do.
No.
90% pure arithmetic, 10% magnetism.
Really?
General Bully found out some of the boys and I were working on this thing, and he convinced us that without it, we'd lose the Cold War.
Oh.
The urge to find out if our arithmetic could be made to have a material form to walk like a man, if you see what I mean.
Oh.
Well, I regret to say it was too great a temptation for us, and we built it.
Really? Well, sounds like the story for a great movie someday, the Whopper and the Tweety, huh?
Yes, it could be.
We need, I think, to learn to understand the realities of life abroad not so much in terms of slogans as in terms of the lives of men. In our response to these realities, there is hope for peace.
Edward Teller had difficulty recruiting scientists to his team. Key candidates argued that development of the super wasn't necessary or moral.
That's when you get your first ideas about things that you're going to do, and you fall in love with the job, and the next thing you know, you can't find that job, and you got a wife and six kids, and she's saying, what kind of a job is that you do?
Well, I make the atom bombs. I can't explain.
Well, I don't see atom bombs on TV, Turkey. How come you're not supporting this family with your atom?
Well, I have very high expenses, my dear. I have to these big bills to the Dildo Plaza Motel for entertaining down there. What can I do? And I have to right now, in fact, darling. I've got to go. See you later.
Atomic Turkey, this fall, on the new television lineup, see a famous scientist reduced to a wimp by his wife, by virtue of the lack of need for atomic bombs. Atomic Wimp, this fall. Chapter 1, the Edmund Teller story.
Teller, Edmund. Atomic Wimp.
But yeah, I made the sex bombs before dinner. Get out of this house, Turkey. I know what you've been doing.
Only atomic thing about you is your breath.
Get out of here.
In my strongly held opinion, the scientists have one extremely important role. And that is to make the best possible science. To find the facts, to find the possibilities. And at that point, their responsibility stops. What to do with the result is up to everybody, and through, in a democratic society, through the elected politicians, the public will has to come to the fore. I have the confidence that if we scientists find the facts, the democratic system, in the end, can develop the right applications.
While Teller was willing to do what the government wanted, Oppenheimer was not. He was deeply troubled by the destruction he and his colleagues had visited upon Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He warned that escalating a nuclear arms race would threaten life on Earth.
But Mr. President, I dropped the goddamn bomb.
You really gave him hell, Harry-san.
If you can't stand the heat, stay out of Nagasaki.
It was Teller's view that prevailed with the politicians. In 1950, when President Truman authorized the H-bomb program, resistance within the scientific community grew. For this, Teller blamed Oppenheimer.
Teller's already wary and hostile, more than he knows, I think, towards Oppenheimer. And now, he believes that Oppenheimer is trying to stop his bomb. He doesn't say it was more difficult because we could never get the mathematical equation right. He blames it on Oppie for an undertow, and this is the symbolic event.
Robert Serber, the physicist who supervised the design of the Hiroshima bomb, was Oppenheimer's disciple and friend.
Oppie to turn on the charm, and so could Edward. And they both were quite vocal. Oppie was one of the few men I ever knew that spoke in English sentences. Perhaps that similarity was contributed to Teller's feeling of inferiority when Oppenheimer was so acclaimed. And Teller was ambitious.
Teller now had his own chance for scientific glory, to show that he, like Oppenheimer, could develop a superweapon. The young man who first came to the United States as a refugee from the Nazis now led the largest American scientific effort since World War II.
Was I ever afraid in connection with war? Yes. When I saw Hitler, I was afraid. When I saw the atomic bomb or the hydrogen bomb, I was not.
Why not?
Because I knew that there is always plenty of power in any stage of development to do practically unlimited damage. Knowledge is important. The only thing I am afraid of is not knowledge, is the people who use the knowledge. And there I did not have reason to be afraid in the case of the United States developing more perfect weapons.
Teller's faith in the good judgment of American democracy was matched only by his fear of the Russians. He once told a colleague that if he didn't build the super, the Russians would take over the United States and he would be their prisoner.
To imagine that he would be a prisoner of the Russians within the United States if we didn't build a hydrogen bomb tomorrow is an irrational statement. There's no question that those weren't nice people. There's no question that that was a terrible criminal regime. But there is much question that they were the real drivers of the arms race. We were the country, the United States was the country, with one notable exception, and that only briefly, that invented the new weapons that the Soviets then followed on and built themselves.
History turns its most ominous page far out in mid-Pacific, where in the Enemy Talk Atoll, the world's most awesome weapon is readied for detonation.
It took 2 years to build Edward Teller's superbomb. At 10.4 megatons, it was 1,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima weapon.
Well, the trouble with the super was that not only that it could be made arbitrarily large, but it couldn't be made arbitrarily small. And nobody knew exactly how small you could make it, but it was intrinsically thought to be a weapon that necessarily had to be many megatons. And there was certainly no military use for such a big bomb. And in fact, there was very little use for it at all, because the same tonnage in smaller bombs would be more destructive.
Are you satisfied from the radiological standpoint, Commander Manet?
Yes, sir. The situation is ideal since the entire fallout pattern is to the north of the inhabited islands.
Thank you, Joe.
No one, not even the scientists who had built the bomb, knew what the results of the test would be.
Niner, eight, seven,
seen a lot of nuclear tests by 1952, who, when they saw the Mike test, were frightened. It just seemed to keep coming at them as they stood on their ships watching this thing grow and grow until the mushroom cloud was 100 miles across.
With the super, America regained its nuclear preeminence. 9 months later, the Soviet Union successfully tested an H-bomb of its own. Robert Oppenheimer's opposition to the hydrogen bomb was interpreted by government officials as disloyalty to the United States. In hearings held by the Atomic Energy Commission, he was stripped of his security clearance and retired to academic life a broken man. Edward Teller was treated as an outcast by many of his colleagues for testifying against Oppenheimer. But he won the battle of the super. He would go on to advise the government on nuclear issues throughout the Cold War.
Gentlemen, can we all take our seats, please? And Professor Rottenheimer, would you stop taking Professor Oppenheimer's seat?
Sit down!
All right, is this working? We've come to Berserkly. To discuss the top secret device. Gentlemen, let me introduce a man who really does know what he's talking about. Let me and introduce Professor Rottenheimer.
Why, thank you very much. I just want to say that atomic physics is my life.
Yeah.
Damn. Can I get a witness?
What? Yes.
What's a witness?
Yes, E equals MC squared. I get it.
You see, if I can make a bomb that will make everybody look at me, I'll feel so good from the beginning.
Well, yes. Yes. Damn.
So I'm going to take a little radium. Think about you, babe.
Think about you. It's bound to be a bomb. Took some radium and mixed it all around.
For you, babe.
You made the bomb. You are plutonic. The man of the hour, Professor Rottenheimer.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I was not thinking for a moment. Song leapt out of my heart because of these physical things that I've... Oh, they number song.
Yes.
Numbers.
Okay, excuse
so
me.
So boring. Do you have any drugs?
Yes.
You young people do to relieve the endless pressures thinking about numbers over and over and over again?
Well, when we get repetitive, Professor, you know the place that we really like to go.
I'd like you to tell me. I'm so uptight. I have every kind of... bladder and bowel disorder and such a wreck.
Well, in the Bay Area, Professor, just get your buns down to University Avenue in Berkeley to the wonderful Dildo Plaza Motel. The Dildo Plaza Motel, where you'll go round and round before finding a place to park around our beautiful fountain in the center. The Berkeley Plaza, where motorcycle gangs gather, 36 people in one room beating each other up, and where women in tremendously high-heeled shoes and short skirts walk directly out on University Avenue to find innocent young college students from Stockton, Fresno, or Tulare. The Dildo Plaza Motel, Professor. You'll find that university professors get an automatic discount.
I think I take your advice. What about these figures?
God damn, they've got some pretty good ones, too, although their faces are ugly as all hell.
I see you've been to the plaza.
No, that's my dentist.
Should we go that way? Walk over to the plaza?
Do you have any radium on you, by the way?
If you're a good boy, we go behind the alley, and you have a pipe?
Yes, I do.
Coal, you say? Coal, did you say, Bill? You talking about coal? Hopefully, the line of opposition to the strip mine machine will continue to stiffen. I mean, no one denies the benefits which coal has brought to a developing nation and a bustling economy.
True enough.
But if men are to find on this land the necessities of life hundreds of thousands of years from now, we must cure ourselves of the expediency complex.
The coal seam was 75 feet under the earth. At the mouth of the tunnel, the coal seam was raised on an angle facing the mountain. We drove the tunnel 100 feet and met the coal seam and faced up the coal. After we drove the tunnel 20 feet, the rock was hard as flint rock. We had to sharpen our old auger often. Sometimes it would take as much as 2 hours to drill one hole. We were going about 1 foot a day in the tunnel. The air was bad. There was no ventilation. We decided to blast one day and clean the loose rock out the following day. We had to get some air in the tunnel, so we bought several joints of black 2-inch pipe and screwed them together and pushed them into the tunnel. We pulled the blower off the blacksmith shop and attached it to the pipe and placed the blower 3 feet from the ground. All you had to do was turn the crank on the blower and pump air into the tunnel.
He tried to transmit his intellectual experience to his brother workers, but with discouraging results.
Ah, get out of here!
Once in the pit, he attempted to explain to them that the world was round, and he spun about vigorously on his feet to drive home his point. Ah!
He's crazy, Louis!
But the men laughed skeptically and declared that his information was absolutely untrue.
Yeah, follow me.
It's
absolutely untrue.
George remained isolated in the spring of his expanding universe.
You know, mountains have been removed, and societies and psychologies destroyed, and surface excavations resembling vast moon craters with hundreds of feet of soil, Bill, and rock discarded in the assault to reach the coal have been left in massive piles.
The tipple set out in a little field. It was 40 feet higher than the drift mouth of the coal mine. To overcome gravity, we built a trestle from the coal tipple back to the ground level of the mountain and laid steel track down the trestle.
Bill.
Then we graded a tram road down the mountain to the drift mouth of the mine. We laid steel track down the incline to the drift mouth of the coal mine. We walked back up the mountain to the top of the grade, installed a hoist powered by a 1927 Chevrolet engine. The drive shaft was attached to the hoist. We hooked a steel cable in the mining car, put the old Chevrolet engine in low gear, and gave her the gas. The mining car climbed up the incline. When the mining car reached the top, we shut off the gas of the engine.
When I became aware that there were actually moonworms around the rocks, I'm afraid I temporarily lost my resistance, and that's when one of these parasites slipped into my head. They don't want to hurt anybody or anything. They just want to live inside others' heads.
Twice tragedy overtook him. Fanny Henderson, a farm servant who became his wife, died of consumption, leaving him with a young son. George's father was struck in the face by a blast of steam and lost his eyesight.
What a blast!
He retired from the pits, and George supported him for the remainder of his life.
You can put me down now, George.
Cole, man, that's really interesting. Cole.
It was a mean time, a time for mean heroes. Heroes like Mike Hammer.
You almost wrecked my car. Well? Get in.
Pulp Fiction Private Eye Mike Hammer was the creation of a former lifeguard and fighter pilot from Brooklyn, who became the most popular writer of the 1950s.
I always said I was a chewing gum of American literature, which I am. I'm not a detective writer. I'm a mystery writer. Now, as Earl Stanley Gardner was a detective writer. He did everything by the book and in good notes. He was a great writer, but he had a different style. My style went into, I had a lot of sex, violence, and love, emotional stuff, and I didn't stay quite to the pattern that they had.
I squeezed until my fingers were buried in the flesh of his throat, and his hands clawed at my arm frantically, trying to tear me away.
When I learned that Mickey Spillane had decided that he himself would play the role of Mike Hammer in the film version of his latest novel, The Girl Hunters. Mickey Spillane's literary status has never been fully defined in America. Hardcore quality lit buffs, however, will recall how he smashed into literary prominence in 1947 by concluding his first novel, I, the Jury, in a manner which made Malaparte, Céline, and other high priests of the Roman Noir look like a bunch of pansies. Quote,
"The roar of the .45 shook the room. Charlotte staggered back a step. Her eyes were a symphony of incredulity, an unbelieving witness to truth. Slowly she looked down at the ugly swelling in her naked belly where the bullet went in. A thin trickle of blood welled out. Her eyes had pain in them now, the pain preceding death, pain and unbelief. How could you?" she gasped. "I only had a moment before talking to a corpse, but I got it in. It was easy," I said.
This confused girl, to make matters even more delightfully noir, was a psychiatrist.
I held him down until he was on his knees and dead as he was ever gonna be.
He wouldn't have reached his peak of popularity if Spillane hadn't been a very good writer. I think Spillane was a writer of enormous energy and invention. But he was driven by the ethos of the period, which was an anti-communist ethos. So Mike Hammer was the ultimate sort of John Wayne hero in a way. You know, the hell with the subpoenas, the hell with the Constitution, particularly the hell with the Constitution, the hell with the Fifth Amendment. If you're a commie, I'm going to shoot you right between the eyes. I'll give you a real good beating on the way.
Where is she? Where is she? Where is she? Where is she?
Mike Hammer was a steely enforcer whose mission was to exterminate those who would destroy America from within or without.
There was a moment when Mickey turned away from your run-of-the-mill bad guys and rats and things to go after commie rats and things, and I think Spillane writes, they were commies. They were real sons of bitches who should have died long ago. They never thought there were people like me in this country. Great stuff.
Spillane's books sold on a winning formula of commie bashing, sex, and violence. An explosion in paperback publishing technology made it possible to turn out millions of inexpensive books quickly. That meant Spillane's novels were available and cheap.
Thank you, ladies. I almost got carried away. Well, next thing I knew, there I was, having huevos rancheros at the old El Palacio Viejo Hotel on the plaza and picturesque Santa Fe with an old friend of mine from Chicago, Mickey Speedway, best-selling writer of hard-boiled paperbacks. Mickey introduced me to Al Capone when I was 10.
I was a Big Al's paper boy.
Excuse me just a minute, Mickey. Kim, could you help me out here? I need a wait person.
Oh, sure. My name is Kimberly. I will be your server, senors. Red or green?
That's red or green, what? What?
Chiles, Mr. Tire Beater.
Oh, which are hotter, my dear?
Some like them green, some like them red. Some like them in the pot with the seeds and the stems, but it really doesn't matter because they are both hotter than 2 weeks in Martinique with Bogart and Bacall.
Yes, thank you very much.
Senor.
Thank you, Kim. Well, why don't you take the red, Mickey? I'm just a greenhorn where chilies are concerned.
No problem, Georgie.
The plates are hot, too, from the oven. Enjoy your breakfast, signores.
Thank you.
Gracias, honey. Drop in on Chicago. Maybe I can get you a gig at Daly's Joint. So, look around you, Georgie. How much is this joint like the Windy City?
Well, you have really cha-cha-cha'd your way into a quaint sort of paradise here, Mickey. Hey, what is it? 3 Mike Dagger books now?
Yeah, with My Gun's the Jury, it's getting up around 1 million copies altogether, George. Ooh. Only 2 bits of a hit, but geez, with those great covers, the ante adds up fast. Men by blondes in the tight red dresses, women by the gun-toting dick in the tight fedora hat. These people in the hotel, they buy them at the cigar stand and they read them. They have a drink, lie awake in their $10 beds, and they read them. Someday, when even your dollar motels have TVs in the room, maybe they won't read Mickey Speedway then. But now, I bet there's a copy of Vengeance is Sweet in the waitress's purse back in her locker.
This is hot. So, Windy's loss is
Adobe's game, Georgie. Yeah, I'm living way on down the old Pecos Trail where nobody bothers the rich gringo writer in his mystery rancho. Confidential sent a photog to shoot me in the buff or something. But there ain't no numbers on nothing out here, Georgie. You can't find some of these haciendas. You get took there.
Whoa, this is really... tell me something, Mickey.
Yeah, sure. What, George?
Which really is hotter, the red or the green?
You want hot, George?
No.
I'll give you hot. Little Mickey Spritzer just walked across the lobby into the barbershop.
Really? L.A.'s favorite mobster? I thought he never left his shoe store.
Only to see what the boys in the squad room will have in small bills. You know, Georgie, I hear he gets a cut on every patent leather brogan in the city copper's use, and they gotta use plenty.
Yeah, well, Mickey runs every racket south of the Coliseum to the county line. Maybe he's here for fiesta.
Fiesta's over, George. It's the day of the dead.
Dead, huh? Well, viva la fiesta, Mickey.
Jeez. You know, if I don't look out, this burg is going to enter the 20th century. Gangsters yet. You know, I may have to move to Alaska. Cuba, maybe.
Oh, Cuba.
So, George.
Yes.
It's great to see you smiling, Beezer. But what brings you? What's the play?
Well, it's top secret stuff, Mix. It could just be another gimmick. Or it could make movies better than ever. You see, I'm out here for Mr. Pingo.
Yeah, Bingo you can play at the Pueblos.
No. J.C. Pingo. You know, he owns Paranoid Pictures, Pan Pacific Airlines, a few buildings around town, a couple of dozen starlets. I meet him sometimes in the back of a donut delivery van.
He don't like limos?
Well, I think he has a few more scars from that last crack-up in his rocket car. He doesn't want people to see him.
Now, Hollywood is for addicts, George. Get out while you have a chance.
Start to finish, senor.
Oh, yes, my dear. I may never use these taste buds again.
What happens next, Mr. Tirebiter?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked, Kim. Well, Mick, I have to buzz out to ground zero.
Well, look me up in Cantina when you get back, Georgie. Big dance tonight. Fireworks. Yeah, I got a friend. Like to meet you.
Oh.
Better hustle now. Don't want to miss the countdown.
The countdown. That's what happens next, Kim.
Oh, I can't wait.
You won't have to. Hey, remember to wear your dark glasses, Georgie.
Critics charged that Spillane was exciting the country's vigilante streak. He was called a dangerous paranoid. His creation, Mike Hammer, a sadistic misfit.
I went to a tea party, and at the tea party were all these funny little people that read books and whatnot. So this guy came up to me, a little bitty guy. He said, now this is what he said to me. I still remember the words, like I'm hearing them from the day when he came out of his mouth. He says, what a terrible commentary on the reading habits of the American public to think that you have 7 out of the top 10 of all-time bestsellers. I said, oh, shut up. You're lucky I didn't write 3 more. Then I did, and I had to change the category out of the 15 out of the top 25.
For an author who once wrote comic books for a living, Mickey Spillane had come a long way. By 1953, his books had sold over 17 million copies. The man who denied any conscious attempt to cash in on the anti-communist hysteria of the day was on his way to becoming one of the best-selling American writers of all time.
This is Mr. Spritzer.
I heard your name, Tirebiter.
Yes, I've heard yours, too. Well, only good things, though, of course.
And this is the crime novelist, Mickey Speedway.
The Mike Dagger guy? Say, you look like him, too.
Hi, Mickey. Hey, Mickey and Mickey. If the mouse were here, we'd have a quorum, right?
I don't get it.
Paperback writer.